All right. Go on.
Such a muppet.
I don't know why I find that so funny. All right, go on. Introduce the show.
My favourite Stormy Daniels film, that, by the way.
Listeners, and welcome to season 2, episode 30. Today is April 19th, and
it is.
You're pretty happy you didn't hear what was said right before the mic. Lucky you today. And with that out of the way, what will we be talking about while the mics are on?
Well,
yeah.
Well, our big discussion this week is
about what is it?
A whole bunch of interrelated things to do with GDPR, the upcoming EU law, and copyright law, and whether you can upload things to GitHub, and what you should be doing with personal data, and all these things tend to tie into one another. So we're going to take a look at the landscape and what's coming up and what we're going to do about it.
We are indeed, and we've said before that we've had bumper news. We continue to have bumper news because we quite like doing the news, and we've got a load of it. We're going to cover all kinds of different things, from Microsoft to Tesla to bully hunters to all kinds of stuff. So stay tuned for that.
And now, Bad Voltage.
You know what? Do you know what?
Literally nobody needs to hear that noise. Do some news.
I would like to concur with that assessment.
I'm just so ready for some news. It's been a long time since I've had some news. I'll stop right there. Let's start with some news. All right.
Such a good segment. Such a poor, poor beginning.
All right. So, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, catch a useless Bad Voltage presented by the toe. Langridge, you go first.
And we're literally all caught.
Okay. So, interesting write-up from a chap called Daniel, who listens to the show, actually, about how software companies, when you're downloading software from their site to install on your machine, an awful lot of them now actually embed a unique user identifier in that download. They're not just saying, you know, here's the executable, or here's the zip file, or whatever, just download, here's the installer, just download it and install it. They're actually customizing that on a per download basis.
Oh, yeah.
With your user ID.
I've noticed this.
Or marketing information. So, you know, like they get the UTM source stuff in URLs, so they can track where you got a link from or so on. They're actually baking those things into the installer that you download, which is then picked up by the program as it's installed. So the program knows, in some cases, how you got that installation of the program. In worst cases, it's a unique user identifier to you, in the same way that ad companies and so on track you around. It's that kind of user ID. And, I mean, maybe everyone in the world knows all about this. I just thought it was really interesting.
Welcome to the internet, Mr. Langridge.
I know. It's,
you can get it on computers now.
Does everyone already know about this?
I've seen this before. I've noticed this when I've installed music software on a Mac or on Windows, and it doesn't ask you to authenticate again. Like, it just seems to bake that in already. So
Okay. No,
I thought it was broken at first.
I thought, you know, Daniel Alexanderson wrote this up, and it came as a surprise to me. So maybe everyone just already knows it, and it's not news at all. It's old, but I thought it was interesting.
Well, it's because all of the software you use is completely free, right? So
yeah,
why would you notice it? So
that is actually a reasonable point. I don't tend to download people's software from their website very much.
Yeah.
So they don't get the option to send me a customized installer.
The news here that to the vast majority of people, including Jono, this isn't news?
It could be, yeah.
We're off to a great start.
Well, I mean, if it's a technical thing and Jono knows about it, it must be pretty common knowledge. Jono being
Is it surprising then that people just accept this, or is it something that should be accepted? I'm curious, which one is your assertion?
It never occurred to me that it even happened. I am reflexively against this sort of thing on principle.
No, are you really?
As you can imagine. I'm not particularly bothered if someone bakes in a thing which says, you know, you got it from this website or from that website or whatever. So they essentially marketing tracking information. Not too bothered about that, really. I'm a bit less happy about the idea of unique user ID stuff. Because that information is obviously not useful if it's just kept on the machine you're on. So they're obviously using it for telemetry, for sending that back to the originator.
Yes.
And saying, the person who did this and looked at these ads on these websites also looked at all these other websites, which we didn't have tracking on. I mean, we don't know they're doing that, but there's no reason to provide this kind of facility unless you want to do stuff like that.
Well, I think generally it's just for tracking usage and consumption.
Yeah,
right?
And
that's the main reason why
tracking is bad. QED.
No, it isn't. It's not necessary. Unethical tracking is bad.
How is baking a unique user ID for you into a download and not telling you about it anything other than unethical?
Because it's unethical to you, but you define your ethics in a very specific way. Most people don't give a fuck.
That doesn't make
they don't care.
You're missing Shut up. You're missing the point. That doesn't stop it being unethical. What you're saying is people don't care about unethical things, and I agree with you.
No, I'm saying that ethics is relative.
No, it isn't.
It is absolutely relative. Bradley Kuhn at the Software Freedom Conservancy defines ethics in a very, very different way to Bill Gates. People
really
define ethics in different ways. Just because you find it unethical, just because you're outraged by it, doesn't necessarily mean that everybody else is. You know? And that's not because they don't have ethics. It's just that it doesn't affect their moral, their ethical compass. For me personally, I don't give a shit. I'm not saying that I'm right or wrong. Just because you care about it doesn't mean that you're right or wrong. It's just we all define it in different ways.
I'm not for a moment suggesting everyone should have to, or indeed does, care about it. What surprised me is that people are doing this, and I don't think it's common knowledge.
But what I'm pulling you up on is the notion that tracking is bad in all of its circumstances.
I think that's a
pretty broad brush to sweep by.
Yeah,
I don't think tracking is bad in all of its circumstances. There is horrendous tracking in technology that all three of us would rabidly agree on. And then there is pretty minimal levels of just seeing if what's happening is happening, you know? And there's a massive line between those two points.
Okay, wherever you draw that line, I think most people would find the idea that they're doing this and keeping it secret from you to at least lead it towards the line,
Again, you're drawing, I think, you're looking for a problem that doesn't necessarily exist. You say keeping it secret makes it sound like a deliberately intentional thing, right? If someone just doesn't, like, there are things that I haven't told you, just because it hasn't come up or because it's not particularly relevant, is that a secret? No, it's a secret if I know something that you should know that I'm deliberately keeping from you, or I'm deliberately keeping you in the dark, right? I think some of these companies who use tracking, it's such a minimal element of how their software operates that they don't disclose it because it's of no interest to the user unless it's going to have any markedly negative impact on them, right? There's certain things that all software does. Just because they don't disclose it formally to you doesn't necessarily mean that it's a secret. It just means that it's not disclosed.
First of all, I disagree, and secondly, so does the European Union, which we should get onto in a bit.
Hopefully, if we get through this news,
news item did not go as I anticipated. I will say that
it was fun, though, wasn't it? I like that.
Quite enjoyed that.
That was literally the deftest segue I've ever done, and you've now pissed all over it.
All right, come on, Garcia, give us some more news.
You want a segue to that one?
Yeah, do it.
Yeah.
That was your news item, right? So go ahead.
Oh, no.
He was talking about the segment, right?
Yeah.
Oh. See, we even fucked up that. We fucked up the fuck up of the segue.
Nice.
You're making it worse. Just
how about the Google loses? Speaking of the... We'll keep the segue going with the the European Union and the UK. You see, the Google lost their right to be forgotten case in the UK recently.
Indeed,
I did.
Yes.
Yeah. What is your opinion on that? I thought it was interesting.
Well, I mean, we did discuss the right to be forgotten some considerable time ago.
Yeah, we did. Long time back. Yeah.
In the show, and our views differed then. I don't think any of them have changed. I think the right to be forgotten is a good idea. You guys were less keen on it.
So I guess it's still not fully clear to me why it's not troubling to European citizens in general to allow their government to really be in charge of and decide what information is and isn't relevant to the public. And I kind of get that you tend to be the EU citizens, I think, generally tend to trust governments more and specifically tend to trust their government more. But it still seems pretty problematic to me.
To me, I think there is a public interest in helping people who are affected by information, which is, to quote Jim Killick, who's director of the ORG, right? He says, the right to be forgotten is meant to apply to information that is no longer relevant but disproportionately impacts a person. I think that's a legitimate case, and that's what the right to be forgotten is targeted to. It's hard to have a discussion about it, because every time you do, people on the other side tend to go, oh, you want people to be able to just delete everything about themselves from the internet? That's totally unrealistic, which is not what it's for.
It seems like it's more about the weighting of that information, right, than the information being available.
I totally see Jeremy's point that it's not necessarily a good idea to decide that the government gets to be the people who decide what information is no longer relevant but disproportionately impactful. But on that point, it's not clear to me that there's anyone else in a position to do it. What governments are for, right? They're the right of last resort.
That's a much longer conversation. It seems to me that they're applying this to technology in ways that don't make sense to me. Because if you were on the front page of the New York Times for doing something, which would be super impactful to you, you can't then go back and say you're not allowed to sell that issue of the Times anymore.
But the important point is that the information is no longer relevant and disproportionately impacts you.
So 10 years later, having been on the cover of the New York Times for something bad, still impactful. People don't forget that.
Yeah. And that's the other point. If you did something that was a big enough deal that you were on the front page of the Times for it, and it's still impacting you today, it's probably not disproportionately impactful and it's probably still relevant. Right?
Neil Armstrong
doesn't get to have the fact that he walked on the moon get forgotten.
Right. That's actually that's a really good example, right? That was a very relevant thing. How many years ago now? Right? And this is interesting to me for two reasons. One is there is, of course, the question. I think we would all agree that there are people who have been very negatively impacted by a freak case of something that a poor decision or whatever, constantly coming up in Google search rankings, and it affects their career, affects their life, whatever. I think we'd all agree that that's a bad thing. But of course, the determination here is it's very much on a case by case basis, and then you're making the individual assertion, not you specifically, the individual assertion of how that should be judged. And I would argue that the government is the worst people to do this, to make this decision. The problem is that the only solution in this are these companies who are building these services, like Google or social media companies or whatever, which are also the worst people to make those decisions.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, this is government are the worst people other than all the others, right?
The other worst people.
Yeah, the legal system is by no means perfect or even good in almost all situations. We just haven't come up with anything better.
This is why I think it's going to be, it's one of those things where we're seeing this more and more where, you know, companies like Google and Facebook and Twitter, you know, they're not just companies with a product now. Like they maintain such a fundamental part of how people's lives operate that there's not just a fiscal responsibility in those companies. There is a social and an ethical responsibility in those companies.
Absolutely,
yeah. And that is a terrifyingly worrying.
But that's kind of the thing, right? I mean, with great power comes great responsibility, and historically, certainly, big tech companies like that have been happy to have all the power, and then when responsibility comes, I was like, oh, nothing to do with us. We're just a tech company. That's government's problem. All we do is we index information. We just connect people together. Not our problem. Yeah. Like, it is now your problem.
Yeah, yeah, well.
This is also semi-relevant to our longer discussion.
Oh, like, wow. Which is increasingly not happening at the rate we're going through this news. So, this is all
points. This is one. Let's move this one because we could talk about this topic ad nauseum, I think. So why don't we move this one to the forum? Because I am curious what the bad voltage community thinks about
Forgotten.
We have, quite a few people in the US, quite a few people in the UK. So I imagine we have pretty varied opinions here. So
yeah,
let's make this part of this show.
It would be worthwhile going back and listening to our previous discussion on this as well, which we could do in detail to see whether what we feared would happen would pan out or whether it hasn't.
That's a good idea. That's a good idea. So I actually have a news item which also somewhat ties to this. James Comey, who obviously was running the FBI until he was fired by the Grand Poobah, has recently released a book. And I haven't read this book yet, but I saw a news article that talked in this book where it said when Apple and Google announced in 2014 that they would be moving their mobile devices to default encryption by emphasizing that making them immune to judicial orders was good for society, it, quote, drove him crazy. He said he went on in the book to lament the lack of, quote, true listening between tech and law enforcement, saying that, quote, the leaders of the tech companies don't see the darkness that the FBI sees, such as terrorism and organized crime. Now, I thought this was interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'm not gonna even try and hide this. I quite like James Comey. I actually wrote something on Facebook yesterday about this. I think that he was put in a very, very difficult position at the center of a shit show of a presidential election where he basically pissed off both sides. But I generally respect his objectivity. To me, it's interesting when he shares a view about this. But the second thing that I think is, of course, there is the question of what is, again, the role of companies in law enforcement, right? There was the whole thing about the San Bernardino terrorist's wife, his phone, and whether Apple should have unlocked it, and Tim Cook was very explicit in saying, we're not going to give that information over to the FBI. And, again, kind of, you can see it from both sides, right? You can see that you need to stop terrorism, but you also need to respect people's privacy. What to me is really interesting about this is a broader issue around the notion of these different bubbles. Because he touches on here that the FBI bubble and the world that people see in the FBI is very different to the world of Silicon Valley.
It fascinates me that he laments the other side not being able to see his perspective while completely not being willing to see the other side's perspective.
Right.
That in itself fascinates me.
And so, but this actually has got me thinking recently in a broader moat about how people do. I think we're seeing more and more of an issue where people lock themselves in their respective bubbles, whether they're ideological bubbles, whether they're places where people live or whatever it might be, and there isn't a communication that happens between them. I mean, I think we've seen this particularly politically in the US with the left and the right, that these divides have got much more broad than they used to be. I just thought it was interesting that he kind of touched on that. And what do you guys think? Like, how does the FBI build a bridge with Silicon Valley, and how does Silicon Valley build a bridge with the FBI and get that right? Because he makes a good point that the FBI will see a lot of nasty shit that Silicon Valley won't necessarily see, but Silicon Valley want to protect the rights of their customers.
That FBI's issue is not lack of data.
To give you a perfect example of that, right? There was a chap who was selling drugs, right? And someone took a picture of his hand holding a bunch of ecstasy tablets and WhatsApped it to a mate, and then the police seized that phone, got that WhatsApp photo, and then ID'd the guy from his fingerprints from a photo of his hand, right? The idea that the FBI are going dark can go fuck itself. However,
they ID'd his hand from
I hadn't seen that. That's bonkers.
Jesus Christ, is that real? Or is that some bullshit that you read on the internet?
It was on the BBC. That doesn't necessarily make it real.
It was an ad for the Samsung Galaxy S9.
But no, that's a real thing. It really is, you see.
Wow.
No, I didn't see that. That's
so great. But okay. I think the fundamental disconnect here is that James Comey and generally people who work for the FBI and law enforcement tend to feel that they have the right, when duly permitted to by authority, to get everything that they want. And people on the other side tend to think that they've got the right to try, but not to succeed. So if you've got that divide, if someone builds encryption that the government can't break, then you go, well, sorry, you're allowed to try, but the fact that you can't succeed sucks to be you, government. And the government tend to think, but we're allowed to see this. If you've built a thing that we're not allowed to see, then you're just not allowed that thing. Because we can't see it, which is ipso facto a knockdown argument against it. And those are two fundamentally different philosophical viewpoints. I don't even think there is a way of bridging that. Those are two fundamentally different ways of seeing the role of government and law enforcement in society. And obviously, people who tend to favour the law enforcement side tend to be, you tend to find more of them working at the FBI, right?
It's tricky, isn't it? Because it seems like part of the challenge here is there's got to be a middle ground between these two areas in terms of how they can collaborate in ways. And I'm sure that they do. I'm sure there's a lot of collaboration between the FBI and these big tech companies. But
I think this is one of those situations, though, where a compromise satisfies nobody.
Yeah.
Neither side's going to be happy with the compromise.
Yeah. No, I think you're 100% right. So anyway, I just thought it was kind of interesting. I'm going to read his book, see if it's any good or see if it's Bobbins. But also that topic, I think, will be interesting. I'd love to hear what the community thinks about this. Like, where do you think the balance is between, you know, governments or government institutions like the FBI and tech companies? Like, where should the line be drawn? What do you think is okay? What do you think is not okay? I'm sure there's a lot of meat on that particular bone. Jeremy, do you want to do another one?
Yeah, let's try to do a couple of quick ones. This one I thought was interesting. I don't think there'll be a ton of discussion, but did you see that there was a man in China caught by facial recognition? Now, that part, not very surprising, but he was caught within minutes at a concert with over 60,000 people.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit surprising. I was just impressed with the speed at which something like that now is possible. They said he had barely made it to his seat in the venue and had already been...
This is just another example. This is why I don't like, you know, Comey saying, you know, we've gone dark. You say, but you could pick out someone's face at a pop concert with 60,000 other people. And that's
only
in minutes. And that's only the technology you've got that's public.
Right. So I just thought it was interesting.
Is that a bad thing?
Oh, boy.
Hang on, what? Say that again.
Is that a bad thing? They can do that?
Not necessarily. I think
the precedent of being able to do that is dangerous.
I don't like the fact that it's possible given the bad uses it could be put to, but it is possible. And I'm not a big believer in trying to uninvent technology because we're worried about it.
And it reminds me, I can't remember who said this, but someone said I forget where I read this, but someone posted something saying that they were irritated with this company because they could only guarantee their security procedures 98% or something like that. And the point I made was, like, you can't guarantee security. You can never 100% guarantee security procedures, right? There's always going to be a potential workaround. That's why, you know, medication is always like 99% effective or condoms or whatever. There's always a potential risk. And you're always going to have that with technology as well, right? I mean, you know,
I would say living at this day and age, living in a Faraday cage on Saipan probably only offers you 99.999% security. So
yeah,
you'd give it up.
To me, the solutions for these things are not technological. You don't say this technology now enables to do bad things, so we must uninvent the technology. It's about the rule of law in permitting what people are allowed to do with that technology.
I agree.
So the fact that this exists is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I've been writing a thing which does facial recognition over the last week or so to run it on my photos. I found it very useful that this is possible. I would be sad if I was precluded away from that software by law. But
that's the tricky thing, is that the people who are necessarily, you know, maintaining the law often think of themselves above that particular law.
which is exactly the problem. And that goes back to the Comey
project I keep meaning to do with you. Hook a Raspberry Pi to a camera and you can connect it to a flow sensor in your kegerator. And it'll actually tell you which one of your mates had how many beers over time based on facial recognition.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't want that switched on. I'm just saying.
All right. Next up.
I have one. Recently, I thought this was kind of interesting. Did you hear about bully hunters?
I did not until you mentioned it. And then I went away and read about it for the show.
I did not.
Yeah, this was it only happened in the last couple of days. So this was kind of an interesting initiative that was produced by a marketing agency called FCB Chicago, I believe. And it's basically, it was composed of an all-female organization made up from Counter-Strike Global Offensive players trying to raise awareness of in-game harassment. So the basic idea of this was, you know, as we all know, there are just some absolute shitheads play online games, and there are horrible individuals who are just, you know, basement dwellers who are just screaming abuse at people when they sit there in their pathetic gaming chairs and their PCs with glowing lights on the inside and their stupid gaming chairs.
Okay.
As an example.
We've tapped a rich vein of resentment here, it turns out.
With their ridiculous neon keyboards and pathetic gaming mice. Anyway, playing esports. I think actually online gaming is quite cool. Those people are bad people who were doing all this harassment. So Bully Hunters was set up as a, quote, vigilante hit squad of elite female gamers. But the idea was that when they are called upon, kind of like the A team, they essentially evaluate the situation, go in and take out the offending player if the case is determined to be severe enough. So it's basically, you know, if someone's being a dick in Counter-Strike, you call in this elite crack team of vigilante female players, and they come in and just blow them away, kind of thing. And on one hand, I thought, That's kind of interesting. But it turns out that this just, it went down like a lead balloon. And apparently there was like some, they had like a debut live stream and it had like some pre-recorded stage gameplay footage. And they were using these branded SteelSeries headphones and had some charity giveaways. But their sponsors didn't really know quite what was going on here. They probably just read, you know, this is an organization that's dealing with harassment in gaming. Yes, of course you want to support that. And a lot of people were thinking, like, this is not the way you go around this, right? This is not the way in which you kind of solve this particular problem. But I just thought it was fascinating. So anyway, they shut down, like, a day after. They shut the entire thing down because it caused such a stir. And I just thought it was kind of interesting. Like, what do you guys think? Like, is vigilanteism the right way to deal with this kind of problem? Or, because it is funny, but does it actually really deal with the issue? Or, I mean, my view is, no, it doesn't. It's probably going to make it worse. He's just fighting fire with fire, probably, in this situation. I don't think you're going to stop dicks in Counter-Strike being dicks. You're going to probably aggravate them with something like that. What do you guys think?
I think you have a reasonable point. I think it's hilarious for a start, and anything which elevates the perception. I don't necessarily feel the same way about people in gaming chairs that you do, Jono. but certainly stamping out harassment in online gaming would be a really, really good thing to happen. We talked a few shows ago about the guardian angels and other sorts of vigilanteism in the real world. And I have reservations about it, but less so, I think, in a virtual world, because there aren't police there or anything like that. There's no one whose job it is to fix this kind of thing. It's untrammeled free for all.
Well, I would argue that it's a game manufacturer's responsibility to provide a platform free of harassment.
And that's where we get back to the social responsibility of company.
We do, absolutely. However, they are doing a spectacularly poor job of doing this, and this is why.
Hang on. Before you go on, I knew you were going to say that. We don't actually know whether they're doing a spectacularly poor job, because we don't know how bad it could be if they didn't put the measures in place. A lot of gaming manufacturers put significant measures in to detect this kind of behavior and deal with it, and cheating detection and all kinds of stuff. We don't really know that they're doing a terrible job, because we don't know what it would be like without those things switched on, to be fair.
Okay, I will grant you that point.
There is still a big problem, not denying that.
Also, if you're thinking of standing as an MP for the Liberal Democrats, that sounds a great deal like their entire policy plan.
I don't keep up with your Hobbit politics.
He noped out of that awful quick.
But anyway, sorry, you were going to say,
In a situation where... This is why people like the Guardian Angels existed in the first place, right? Because they didn't feel that the duly constituted authorities were doing a good enough job, and so they felt they were going to step in. And this is exactly the same argument that people had about them. And yeah, I can kind of see that it's not a bad idea. What do you think, Jeremy?
Yeah, what do you think?
I don't know that my opinion differs enough to... I'm admittedly not a large gamer, so I don't have an educated opinion on whether they're doing a good job or not.
You are not large. I would agree with that.
Oh my God. you are also dancing like that guy who did Riverdance around that question.
Also, we're running super short on time, and I have like 4 news items left, so I...
It's like, shut the fuck up, let's get on with it. Okay. Go on then, Jeremy. Give us some more of your juicy, juicy news.
Well, one that I think people are going to want us to cover is this announcement from Microsoft. So I figured we should at least be able to dedicate more than 8 seconds to it, because we are rapidly running out of time. Sure that, and this was just announced very, very recently. So news, once again, as this seems to be a trend here, is coming out pretty rapidly. So we're very early in what's available from an actual information standpoint. But for the first time ever, Microsoft is going to distribute its own actual version of Linux. And they announced this officially yesterday. It's called Azure Sphere. And there's some cool components here, but basically what it is a almost custom branded Linux kernel specifically aimed at IoT devices. And there's a couple really cool things here, and I thought it was more interesting, and the more I read, the less interesting I think that it is. But I'm still forming an opinion. But so, for those of you who haven't seen it, what it is they're doing some custom processors, which I thought was really interesting, that are aimed at smart appliances, IoT devices, connected toys, and other gadgets, as they worded it. And then from there, like I said, it's a custom version of Linux. And the thing that I originally thought was cool was that they are offering, as part of this, a service where they guarantee automatic security updates for a minimum of 10 years. So more secure IoT devices, I think, is great. Microsoft realizing they couldn't do this with with Windows and choosing Linux, I think is interesting. The part where I am now a little less interested in those two things, I should say, kudos to Microsoft, fascinating. It looks like you need to use Visual Studio.
Actual Visual Studio.
Not VS Code, not any of the actual Visual Studio. That completely ruined it for me. So like I said, I've seen this in a couple places. I've not been able to verify it 100%, so I don't want to say that it's 100% true right now as we're recording. We'll definitely know by the time the show is released, so we can update the show notes. But if that's the case, that would be a killer.
Yeah. I mean, historically, things that are possible in Visual Studio are possible without it. They're not generally using secret proprietary Microsoft technology, which is completely unavailable outside Visual Studio. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they'll tell you how it works.
Someone else could build the ability to do this.
So if they have built this thing and said, you can now build these devices, but you have to go and buy a copy of Windows and run it in order to develop for it, then the hell with that. That's really disappointing. It should be pointed out that both Fred Vaughn and Ryan McDonough, I'm not really sure how you pronounce his name, both mentioned on Twitter that we predicted that Microsoft would release their own Linux distro this year as part of our predictions. And we did. Yeah. Hooray. Hooray for us.
But from a technology perspective, it looks really interesting. Obviously, Canonical was trying to do this as well, so I'm sure you guys have opinions. John, because you were starting to talk there.
No, I was just going to say, you know, I'm just really proroud that we got that prediction right, as well as the Facebook VR one.
I thought you were going to say something interesting.
I'm going to buy you a drum just so you can sit there and bang it over and over again.
But I think the custom processor and clearly more secure IoT devices is something that we need. I would have liked to see Canonical maybe get this one correct earlier. But I think it's going to be a difficult market to crack because from a pricing perspective, I think a lot of IoT devices are obviously a race to the bottom. But having a bunch of, they released the other day, it came out that one of the recent casino hacks was actually done by a smart thermometer. So
yes.
I heard about that.
Becoming increasingly clear that these devices need to be secured. Stewart's let's not connect them to the internet thing probably is... The horse is out of the barn, as they say.
That's how you solve the problem. You could eliminate 80% of the IoT problem tomorrow if everyone started shipping IoT devices that you connected to on your LAN rather than round-tripping everything through their stupid server that someone wrote in a weekend.
Yeah, it's the new generation of things devices. This to me is massively unsurprising. Like, this is, you know, logical next step.
I think this is the full extent now of Microsoft realizing they are a services company and Azure is their future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they don't really care that it's Linux. They want you to buy Azure.
Well, certainly the Azure brand is their future, if nothing else. What has this got to do with Azure? Nothing. It's called Azure Sphere.
Because you have to subscribe to the Azure. It's part of the Azure service because it is a...
Yeah.
It's a subscription service. I mean, it provides security updates from the cloud, and their cloud is called Azure.
Oh, no, okay, no, that's fair, I suppose.
I mean, Azure is basically their platform now.
Yeah. So,
and from what I understand from people who I know at Microsoft and from what I've seen outside, they're killing it. They're doing incredible stuff with Azure.
They are doing a good job. I'm keen on their goals for this. I'm just concerned, and I sound like a 2002 era Linux person here. What they're going to do is they're going to take something which could be quite good, and then bake a bunch of secret Microsoft lock-in stuff into it.
And you know what you do? The market decides.
Really?
Don't use Microsoft. Yeah.
Okay, I wait eagerly for the market to decide to not use Facebook.
Curious to see if this will open Amazon to making the underlying Echo platform more available in a lockdown manner.
Right.
Google.
Well, Google are doing it now. You can download the Google Assistant software and run it on hardware of your choice, essentially. They're already pushing. You can essentially build yourself a Google Home if you want to now.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Which is actually quite cool. I mean, it's not open source or anything, but you can do that. I mean, I think people are doing it with Raspberry Pis and stuff like that, but certainly given specific hardware, you can just download it and run it yourself. Yeah.
I'm surprised they're doing that. I mean, obviously they have a partner program. There's like JBL speakers and various other speakers that come with Google Assistant, but I'm surprised that they're doing that in a general case.
Yeah, well, Amazon have also sort of done it in that you can download Echo software and run it on hardware of your choice, but it's in this kind of quasi-supported, quasi-not-supported, if you use this, we reserve the right to just break it tomorrow and laugh at you about it kind of place. There's a thing called echosim.io, which is essentially runs a web service, right? And you can sign into it as... and it works like an Echo. So you can speak to it and it sends all the stuff off to Amazon and it comes back and speaks to you again. And it's quite handy for testing out skills that you've developed and stuff like that. But you do get the impression that it's half a thing which is supported and half kind of weirdly reverse engineered. Like, you know, it's like a third party WhatsApp client. It's if it becomes too big a deal, they might just cut it off tomorrow, you know?
Yeah. Wow. Cool.
Yeah, curious to see if there'll be uptake on this, because, I mean, Samsung's been doing this for a while with Arctic, and I don't know that a lot of people use it, so I wonder if the Microsoft brand will change that. But
That will be cool. Interesting.
Probably time for one or two. What do you?
Yep.
Anyone got anything good?
What have you got anything, Langridge? I'm out. I only had two.
I'm good. So one more from Jez, and then we're good.
Oh well, so this one I have three, but one of them's more just to mention because I think it's funny. Do you see the IRS site went down today on the last day to pay your taxes?
I did. Yeah.
It's 2018, and we're still having IT infrastructure problems. Computers are hard.
I think I've told this story before. I ended up having a beer somewhere with the guy who runs the Comic Relief website. Comic Relief is a charity that happens every couple of years here in the UK.
It's happening more and more in the US now as well.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, yeah. So essentially what he's got is he's got 2 years, so 730 days, 729 of which are thinking up ways to future-proof and load balance the website, and then one day during which everyone on Earth hits that website. and he said all you can do is, you know, you spend all your time trying and saying, well, what if this happened and what if this happened? So, but there's no load balancing tool or, you know, a surge or anything like that which can test what it's like in this situation. You just have to build all your things and hope, and you get to test it once a year, and the IRS will be exactly the same.
Why, I mean, presumably there are people who filed their tax returns a month ago. Why wouldn't you take the traffic logs from the previous year and just replay them? Or use Chaos Monkey, or this is a solved problem, in my opinion.
I think part of the problem is that the guy, apparently the guy from the Panera Bread, is now working at the IRS.
That would actually be the problem, I think.
That's not true, by the way. Just seeing anyone thinking that means...
Just go to irs.gov/everybody and it just lists everyone's tax return.
Yeah. Makes things a lot easier, doesn't it?
You live on.
So my other one was a Tesla shut down Model 3 production for a week, which does not bode well for my prediction.
It does not.
But I figured I'd mention it as an update. And the last one, since we are out of time here, but this one's important, is they just Google just released their numbers on how many people enable 2FA in Gmail. And it's less than 10%. So we're wrapping up this segment right now. Press pause. Go to whatever email provider you use and enable 2FA, please. Thank you.
Yeah, no, and that's interesting because... I mean, obviously, people should have two-factor authentication enabled, right? But I think it is just, it's confusing to a lot of people, I think. I remember when I was, when I joined GitHub, and as part of the onboarding, you know, there was a requirement that, of course, all of your accounts there are 2FA enabled. And for a lot of the technical people, you know, it wasn't particularly surprising. We used to use YubiKeys at Canonical, for example. But for a lot of the people who were joining in like marketing or business development or whatever, it was massively confusing for them. So, and Google have made it about as easy as you can get it. But I think it's just still
Google Authenticator, if you choose to use that, it's pretty simple. Authy is pretty simple. Great. I prefer the YubiKey as well, but just use something, please.
Just do it. Yeah, it
just,
is important.
Just do it.
So, all right. Are we done?
We're done.
We're just empty of news. So every day I listen to the NPR news headlines. And one of the things I heard last week, I think it was that Craigslist have basically shut down their kind of like personals kind of section, which is all about, you know, people basically offering sex services, like, you know, masseuses who basically will knob you and all this kind of stuff. And also, I believe that the similar kind of thing has happened to a site called Backpage.com, which I'd heard of previously as being like kind of that Craigslist section, but on steroids. And apparently the reason for this is a recent ruling in the US, and I forget the exact name of it, but it was basically that previously service providers could say, such as Craigslist, you know, whatever happens on our site, the content that people put on our site, we're not responsible for. We just merely provide the service. So there was a real problem with these sites with human trafficking, which is obviously a terrible issue. And this decision was made in the courts that companies can be held liable for content that's on the site. So consequently, the companies have changed their tune on this kind of thing. And I think it opens up an interesting question, which, you know, we alluded to throughout the news and we've talked about in previous shows, which is, where is the balance between a service that a company operates and the content that appears on it, right? So this also came up last week when Mark Zuckerberg was testifying in court, in front of the Senate. And he was talking about how, for example, apparently they have like 1,000 people at Facebook who work in their anti-terrorism department. And Facebook, as part of their general principles, will try to take down, obviously, like terrorist material and illegal material and things like that. But there's still a significant amount of, you know, pretty unsavory material that is on all of these different services. So the question is, like, where is the line and where should it be drawn? And it doesn't just apply to social media sites or sites like Craigslist, but it could apply to places like GitHub. Like, what kind of content can and should appear on GitHub and other things that relate to the open source world? So what do you guys think about this?
I mean, this is such a broad, wide, it's sweeping mammoth, topic. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, Section 230, which is one of the things that's coming under fire recently, is something near and dear to LQ, because I don't know that LQ would have been possible. But more broadly speaking, I don't think that most interesting internet services would have been possible without the protections that Section 230 provides. And so, I don't know how familiar, I'm probably overly familiar with it because of LQ, but for people that aren't really familiar with what Section 230 is, it's the segment of the communications law that says that a provider is not responsible for something that is said on their platform if they're truly just a publisher and they're not publishing it. The content themselves, so third-party user-generated content, you are not liable for. So if someone at LQ posts something, I'm not responsible for that because we're providing a platform that's interactive in nature and a computer service, which is how it's worded. And I think there's a bunch of laws coming. It seems predominantly to be in the EU, but obviously the one affecting Craigslist is in the US, that I think the EFF got the sentiment right with the one of the titles of an article they wrote was, in passing SESTA and FOSTA, lawmakers failed to separate their good intentions from bad law. And I think that the trend here is that there are valid technological and societal issues that clearly need to be addressed. But we're picking really, really problematic solutions to do that. Ones with a ton of unintended consequences, enough gray area that people don't even know how to fulfill them. And I think there's a couple reasons for this, but they really are societal. And so that makes it very difficult to fix. But I think, kind of from my perspective, broadly speaking, we've relied on people making pretty shallow surface-level laws to correct deep, tangled, intricate problems for so long that it's now kind of coming home to roost, right? And it's, let me clearly preface this by saying that I am not a lawyer. I do not play one on a podcast. But just because of things that I like and the role that I have in multiple facets of what I do for work perspectives, I increasingly read more and more law. And it's clear to me when you start looking at some of these laws, and just for a little background for those of you who don't know me, I'm big on building understandable, fundamentally sustainable systems that work at a very systemic level. And when you start mentally diagramming out some of these laws, it's very clear that they have little or no structure. An actual system architect would look at these and stroke out, right? There's no really thought to consequence. There's very little guidance for interpretation or how it should be built. And in many cases, increasingly you hear the lawmakers didn't even read the laws. They just pass them because they came up, and especially in the US, people increasingly just vote with whatever party they are and don't even really care what the law says. And it turns out that results in pretty crappy laws, which is, I think, what we're getting here. So I think, with all that said, I don't know how the path forward to fix all these issues are, but from my perspective, that's kind of how we get where we are.
That was going to be my kind of gut reaction here. Was I think we would all agree that service providers should be protected from people who abuse their service for nefarious reasons to a reasonable extent. But there is always going to be, you know, illegal content and whatever, you know, that could manifest, and there needs to be a way of dealing with it. But
so, like, if, for instance, if I ignore a DMCA request, I do get in trouble. So there are exceptions and sane rules.
Yeah,
but I like, what is the solution? I mean, I can't think of a solution to this. Is this just the only option we've got? What do you think, Mike?
I mean, I absolutely take Jeremy's point that an awful lot of the laws we get attempt to treat this. They very much treat the symptoms rather than the disease. They're fixing things at a superficial level and not actually fixing the problem, which means that the problem just pops up again 5 minutes later. And I understand that concern. It's just... it's not clear to me you can do anything else because you're not allowed to just pick up the world and shake it like a snow globe so it looks like how you want. And what's interesting here is, and this is somewhere where I think Jeremy and I would disagree, is that I think it's a good idea to come up with laws which do treat things at a fundamental level, but I think that's what the GDPR is. And I think Jeremy would say the GDPR is... maybe the opposite, and is the kind of superficial law he's worried about. But I may be mischaracterizing.
So, have you just out also, of curiosity? Go ahead.
I was just going to say,
we're going to get into explaining what it is.
Explain what it is.
So, sorry, Jeremy, you can ask a question first.
Out of curiosity, and I legitimately don't know the answer to this, have you done any kind of GDPR compliance work with companies or gotten into actually trying to satisfy what the law says in a real world sense?
I have not specifically consulted two companies on it, not a lawyer, but I have. I do work with companies who are also doing it. So I'm not involved in the project intimately, but I have spent some time talking to companies who are currently going through this and seeing the issues that they're coming up with. And if there are more of you, then, you know, give me a ring. But
yeah,
actually, so, no, for God's sake, don't ring me up and say, make us GDPR compliant. I'm not doing that.
I was
going to
say, with the give them a ring, why don't you give a brief overview of your... interpretation of what GDPR is.
So, I will give you my interpretation of the GDPR, which comes from what I believe its goals are. I think if we, the three of us, and people like us, frankly, were to sit down and come up with some kind of a set of overriding principles about what companies should be able to do with everyone's personal data... so, what you're allowed to collect, how much you have to tell people about what you're collecting it for, what you're allowed to do with it once you've got it, how long you should keep it once you've got it. And I think we would all skew roughly towards the don't collect stuff that you don't need, don't keep it around forever, don't use it for weird, surprising stuff that people don't like, don't hook it up with loads of other databases, not tell anybody, don't sell it without at least saying you're going to do it. That sort of generally understood approach to data collection that the open source mindset has, the GDPR is the European Union legal system's attempt to come up with a set of laws which actually do that.
But it's not just that.
That's their goal, right? That's absolutely their plan.
I actually don't think that is their goal. I think that's one half
of their goal. What do you think
the other half? I think that one half is that. I think the other half, which is a significant chunk of the GDPR from what I've seen, is making companies have the right security provisions in place for them to not leak information
To me, that's a technological consequence of the goal. Right. So, yes, I agree with you. Okay. Yes, that's a big part of it. But that's an implementation detail. If you're going to keep people's data secure, part of that is it doesn't get leaked and therefore you must be secure against being hacked and therefore you must do the following things. But to me, that's a technological consequence of the social goal of the law.
I'm not sure I agree. I think you were talking about on this one.
Okay, fine.
I think you were talking about policy, and then there is protection.
That's responsibility. Fine. I mean, that's purely.
But either way, it all pans out.
That's purely my interpretation of it. To me, I think the goals are noble, and I think the GDPR is a reasonable attempt to pursue those goals. Everyone thinks it's an absolute nightmare. Some of the reason it's a nightmare is justified and some is not. I think some of the reason it's justified is when you try and take a kind of big picture social goal, which is intended to fundamentally change the way technology and companies deal with people. So this is exactly pursuing that kind of big societal changing goal that we think is a good idea. I think when you actually try and make that into a concrete law, you end up with a million special cases and edge cases and so on. It's like tax law, right? Million special cases. But the second problem, and this is perhaps where I differ from a lot of people, is that, yeah, GDPR is a nightmare, but I think the reason it's a nightmare is because everyone's been massively lax about dealing with personal data, and now you're not allowed to be lax anymore, and everyone's bitching about the fact that it's hard.
I completely agree.
Really?
I mean, like, people have certainly been lax, no, but I think, it's, at least from my perspective, it's worded so broadly and it's so wide and not deep enough that it almost seems impossible to comply to it, which makes it problematic, in my opinion.
Well, the tricky thing here, I think, is that GDPR requirements are now starting to enter into contracts, right?
Yeah.
So I'm starting to see this with my clients. And the language in those contracts is breathtakingly generic. It is having, for example, a security policy, right? Now, a security policy could be, you know, I'll change my password once every 2 years, or it could be something way more
Bob
involved.
In the mailroom looks after security is a security policy. It's not a very good security policy, but it's a security policy.
So I think it's one of those things where the language that, at least that I'm seeing, and the limited number of cases that I've seen, is very generic. But obviously people want to be in compliance with their contracts. But despite those genericisms, putting those necessary pieces in place to comply broadly with the policy, by definition, makes that individual or that company much more secure. I think it accomplishes the goals of GDPR much better than we've got today. But I just think a lot of this stuff is so generic. I'm not sure how much you would stand up in court if someone took
And just to for those of you not familiar with it, for a very high level, what it really comes down to is there's some components around data control. So things like how you process data, making sure it's accurate, things like that. There's some stuff around security, so how you safeguard people's data. There's some stuff around right to erasure, which I think is especially problematic.
There are
some interpretations of GDPR that would indicate that mailing lists are now carte blanche illegal.
Yes.
Where mailing lists are by definition illegal is, to me, absurd to a level that it's going to be problematic enough that it probably should have been rethought.
Sorry, Jeremy, explain that. I've not heard that before. What element of GDPR would make mailing lists
illegal? And once again, this is by some interpretation, so this would be to the strictest interpretations. In many cases, clearly by lawyers who want to sell you GDPR services. But because the right to erasure comes down to you always have the right to revoke your consent, and if you do, the organization has to have a policy around how they delete your data. Because once an email goes out, everyone has your email address, you could not conceivably erase that personally identifying information. It wouldn't be possible because of how email works.
Yeah.
So you send an email to a mailing list. Right. It gets archived. It gets archived in a million other places. Therefore, you can't maintain that.
Therefore, since you are not in a position at that point to reach out and delete that from everything, but you have to be in a position to delete everything in order to run a service, no one's allowed to run mailing list services. Now, to be clear...
But surely terms and conditions will take care of that.
Because the fact that you have to have the implicit right to revoke your consent is in the law.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, you can't get out of GDPR requirements by writing in your terms and conditions, we don't apply with the GDPR in this situation. No. You have to comply. Now, the people saying that this makes mailing lists illegal are like the people who think you don't have to pay income tax because Ohio wasn't a state when the 16th Amendment was ratified, right? They are mental. And it's not going to shake out like that. But as with all big laws, I suspect what there's going to be is a few high-profile test cases where someone was doing something that seemed legitimate and it turns out they get screwed. And as far as I can tell, an awful lot of companies are kind of quietly doing a few GDPR bits, aren't really very sure how far they have to go, and just hoping they're not the test case, which is not ideal, but this is how big law changes work, right?
Yeah, and there's going to be a period of normalization, right? At the beginning, it's going to freak everybody out, and then things will sell. Is what's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I do...
Sure,
and it's not like every law is read to the letter of the law.
The problem I see more and more, like the copyright law that the EU is passing, where there's a link tax proposal, which is now an inalienable right, that is bonkers to me. Like, I don't... If the laws continue to pass at the rate they're passing with the wording that they're containing, I don't know how the internet exists in 10 years.
What is a link tax? What is that?
So the biggest and most worrying change, as was put in this new thing, would be... So Spain kind of did this before, didn't make it an inalienable right. Google looked at the law and was like, lol, and now Google News doesn't exist in Spain. What the EU did as a response to that is make it an inalienable right, so you can't give it up as an organization. So Google would have to decide, because I'm trying to think, the UK, I think, made this law, a similar law to Spain, but didn't make it an inalienable right. And so some entities gave the right away. So now it's an unalienable right. But what basically what it is
so confused right now.
It would take very long to explain fully, I guess.
Right.
But it's, so you would need to pay a copyright-like fee for a website if you wanted to use a news snippet as part of quoted text in your link. It is how the law...
You have to pay a fee.
Correct. And like I said, unlike in some versions of the law, in the current EU version, it's an unalienable right.
Right.
You can't... You cannot choose to not do it.
There are... This whole discussion about the GDPR tends to get conflated with similar laws, like the EU copyright stuff that's going on. This is what GitHub have been complaining about. For people who haven't seen that, the EU copyright law that's currently being discussed, as it currently stands, would make GitHub essentially have to implement something like YouTube's content ID. But instead of for music, it would be for all copyrighted things, right? GitHub have obviously gone, are you taking the piss? There's no way we could do that. Not only can we not do it, it's not even possible. It's not content ID. At least there is a big bank of all the copyrighted music. It's what Spotify have got access to, for example. So you can at least scan all uploaded things for all, you know, a good proportion of all existing copyrighted music. This is in no way the case for all existing copyrighted things. And the GitHub people have gone, this is stupid. We want an exemption for software repositories.
I don't see how GitHub could comply to the GDPR.
Why? Do you not see that?
I write a bit of code. I sign that code, and then I commit it to a repository with my email address.
Yeah?
I then put in a GDPR request to remove my email address.
Yeah?
The commit's signed, so you can't alter the metadata.
I don't see why they can't just delete the code in that situation. I don't know exactly how that law would shake
out. So then I can submit a bunch of code to a project, make that project rely on the code, submit a GDPR request, and completely screw the project.
Well, I don't see why you can't remove the commit. Although I don't know exactly how that will shake out. But again, someone saying, well, this just makes Git impossible then, doesn't feel to me like they're looking for reasons... for ways for this to work. It looks like they're looking for reasons to just abandon the whole law as unworkable. And, you know, so you say, okay, so given that that's the situation, how can we make it so we can remove someone's email address from a signed commit but keep the commit around? Right?
It's kind of the whole reason you sign things, so it can't be... That's why you sign things, so it can't be altered and you can verify the commit.
Right, but...
If you're just able to... alter signed commits, then why are we signing commits?
No. You can't alter a signed commit, but can you just remove that commit, for example? I don't know. Can you remove the commit and keep the code? Can you take the code from that and have someone else sign it in order to keep it in the project? I don't know the technical detail of that.
That's going to cause some issues with copyright. Well,
I mean, it's...
Exactly. And yeah, we need to work this stuff out. And yeah, there are...
But I don't know how you write a law with a specific date that goes into implementation that has pretty severe legal and monetary repercussions.
Extremely severe.
And you have to... And we'll figure it out. Like, that's not how companies work.
On the flip side, it is how the law works. Any fairly serious, and again, societal changing law is not just what was written on the bit of paper, but a whole bunch of precedent since then. Yeah, it is unfortunate that we haven't specified every single edge case for every single thing at the moment the law was written. Removing my name from a signed commit in a Git repository is an edge case.
That specific thing is a specific case, but that concept applied broadly is not an edge case.
I would say that that's not an edge case. That is at the heart of...
Given that it's a technology
source,
law.
Running infrastructure
it's
in the world.
Well, no, it isn't. Having having what? Someone's email address attached to a signed commit in a Git repository is not fundamental to open source. Otherwise, it would have existed before Git existed.
It is absolutely fundamental to the way open source is built and created today.
No, it absolutely is not. No, yes, it is. If you changed everyone's signed commits so they just said JEJB rather than your email address, it would not fundamentally break open source.
No, I agree with that.
I agree, but that's not a workable scenario. Because that's not how companies operate.
What do you mean that's not how companies operate? What are you talking about? I don't understand your objection.
Well, so there's a couple of reasons why I don't think this is going to... So first of all, to the point that you made earlier on about people who look at an issue and they're only looking at a way of finding fault in it, there is as much of an issue with people who will look at an issue and only find good things in it, right? I would argue that in this particular situation, this legislation does not map to the pragmatic way in which enterprises build open source. And there is a whole copyright and a recognition and a credit angle to why people participate in open source projects, large public open source projects that power infrastructure and devices around the world, right? The idea that these companies can merely remove some pieces of it, which doesn't even get to the copyright issue. I just think technically, yes, you could do that, but realistically, it's not going
to
happen.
No, this is the point though, right? With the copyright and the credit issue, you have asked for your name to be removed. You can't simultaneously say, I want my name removed from that thing, but I also still want copyright and credit on it. Otherwise, by definition, you want it to remain personally identifiable.
I agree with you from the perspective of the person who wants the content removed, but what about the people who are facilitating the project?
Again, what difference would that make to them? If that commit suddenly didn't have their name on it and just had removed at GDPR... Right, so you take the code from
Removed. It's removed at GDPR, and now someone makes a copyright infringement claim. How do you handle that?
Do you
go blame removed at GDPR?
That's exactly. A good question.
The point here
is, I think it makes at a very fundamental level open source untenable, and any law that does that concerns me.
Because if
companies now look at GDPR, look at open source, and be like, it's not worth the risk. To me, that's a net loss.
I have to say, I'm astonished, language, that you're not objecting against this.
I feel like...
It's not just GDPR, though. Layered, the other things that are happening, like the copyright law, that is worse. I'm very concerned at a very high level.
I'm certainly concerned about the copyright thing. I completely agree with you on that point. On the GDPR,
so I'm trying to take a broader view of the direction that lawmaking entities are going.
Yeah, specifically, that's fair. I mean, part of the thing, and I take Jono's point that maybe I'm a bit too far on the defend it rather than argue about it side. But I think it is rare that we see laws which are attempting to do something that I really believe in, right? An awful lot of laws we see that come in and change society are fucking it up in ways I don't like. When something comes along which is attempting to reverse that and doing a thing which I actually agree with, I kind of think, I like that.
Yeah, but again, in the same way that you made the comment earlier in the show about, you know, gaming companies, how they're doing a terrible job, we don't know, in the same way that we don't necessarily know... we can't make that assertion because we don't know how bad it would be without those provisions in place. A lot of the laws that are put into place that do good things, you will have never have heard of, right? By definition, the things that we hear of are, in general, probably pretty controversial things, and that's why we pay attention to them. A lot of the boring shit that, like, makes the world go around, we probably never hear of. So probably most laws are actually reasonable. And I agree with you, Ak. Like, the spirit of this law, I think, is... I would say that there is the spirit of the law and then there's the letter of the law. The spirit absolutely makes sense.
Yeah, I mean,
But the letter seems to be
I absolutely understand your point. If I have the right to have my personal data rectified or erased, and some of that includes an email address on a commit, and you say, okay, how do we need to solve that problem? What would we do? I mean, put it another way, right? Imagine I make a commit to a project, and then later on I say, I'd really like to not be associated with this project. Currently, the people who run the project have the right to go, we don't give a shit about your opinion. We're going to keep your name in there and we're never going to remove it. Fuck you. We don't care about what you think. And they're allowed to do that, but that's a pretty unreasonable thing to do. So if you grant that it would be reasonable to attempt to rectify that situation, what would you currently do about that? Assuming you wanted to be nice, not that you were legally compelled.
I think that this is an edge case. People who do want to remove software from open source projects, I get that. I think it is an edge case. And it actually raises the interesting question, the right to be forgotten in open source projects.
Yeah. Do you have the right to have your participation forgotten? And I don't know whether that means all your commits get removed or whether just your accreditation for your commits gets removed.
I have so many opinions on this because it gets to the crux of asynchronous workflow and why that's important. So anyway, we have talked about this for too long.
We barely
scratched the surface is what's scary.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, this is such a huge
I want to hear
topic.
What people think on the
We didn't even talk about it. Didn't even talk about the GitHub content ID thing, really.
No.
Well, maybe we'll continue this discussion in the next show. Because there's more meat on that particular bone.
It'd be interesting, we'd like to hear from you about what you did or didn't understand about this, which directions you specifically like to see drilled into in even more detail. I've spent the last week reading up on this stuff. And seriously, I've barely even scratched the surface, exactly as you say. So if you'd like to see something a bit more detailed, I'm not going to promise we'll do it, but we're going to listen.
Yeah, absolutely.
We will definitely listen, particularly if the Space Raiders attached to the offer.
I'm not rebranding the forum again.
It's still rebranded, partially.
I'll be honest with you. I think I didn't download the image that we replaced.
Oh, you numpty! For those of you,
I did download it. I just need to find
For those of you who don't look at the forum, first of all, what's up with you? Go look at the forum. But secondly, we did actually rebrand the forum in line with the papal weekend after the last show, and it was great. And then we turned off the branding, so no more huge popey picture and all that kind of thing. But one of the images now says Bad Vulture Community with a little picture of Popey's face. And I said to Jono, I can't find the original for that image. Please, could you put the original back? And it turns out now we don't have the original for that image, you numpty.
The problem is I did download it. I just don't know where I downloaded it to. So I'll find it. So anyway, so Elvis Popey.
So there is a small corner of this field which is forever Popey. It turns out.
We will fix it. We will. That's it. We have another show. Not just in the can, but in the best of cans. The can that has been open and lasted for a very long time. How long have we been doing the show now?
What are Three you years? Going on about? Oh, I thought you meant like, you know, an hour.
I have no idea. this is the...
I appreciate that was a bit random.
This has got to be about the 112th show.
Something. Yeah. Been doing it for a while now. Wow. So
terribly long
time. It's a bit of fun. I have nothing else. I think we're done.
Well, there are a couple of things I wanted to mention. The first one is that last week's show was not meant to be called Extra Meaty Skid, and I apologise for that. after there were a bunch of Skid Row jokes, it was meant to be called Extra Meaty Skid Row, which was supposed to be, you know, a slight nudge in the direction of unpleasantness, but an amusing punny title, and it was just flat out unpleasant because I typed it wrong and published it. And
Extra Meaty Skid is.
I know. And,
it is gross.
And that,
to be fair.
It is. And that was my fault. And I apologize sincerely for that. The problem is that once you've already published it, changing it just screws everything up. So we were stuck with it. And I apologize. Sorry for that. A few people said, seriously? And I'm like, yeah, sorry. So hands up on that one. The other thing I wanted to mention is, and I think I've said this before, every year in the UK we do a thing called Foss Talk Live, which is a bunch of open source podcasts all get together. And this year it's happening again on the 9th of June 2018 at the Harrison, which is near King's Cross in London. I believe all tickets sold out now, so you know, sorry.
So why are you telling people about it?
Because I was meant to say it a month ago. But first of all, not everyone shows up. Right. And if you come along, there'll be, I'm sure you'll be able to get in something. And there's a bunch of different people going. The Ubuntu podcast people are going. The Guys from Linux Voice are going. The Late Night Linux people are going. Me, Marius Quarbeck, yep. Dave Means Nichols. So it should be a fun evening. It always is normally. So you should come along. 9th of June in London. You can go to fosstalk.com, I think.
You can go and be in the same room as Stuart Langridge and Dave Mega Slippers.
You can.
both of which are salt of the earth human beings. I wish I could go over it.
And then you could be in the same pub as us afterwards as well.
Who would have thought that, eh? Nice.
Are you chaps speaking anywhere in the next couple of weeks?
I'm not.
No, we're all.
It's been nicer.
Boring home.
No travel. I know. I don't have any travel until July, which is nice.
Wow, that is nice.
Yeah, it's lovely. I love being at home.
I don't believe for a moment that's the truth.
No, it's true.
But I'm sure something will come up in between now and July. And you'll have to go.
Probably.
Right at the moment.
I'm going to Google I.O. Looking forward to reporting on that. And there's an event in San Francisco called DevXCon, which is run by the one and only Matthew Revell.
Yes.
I'm going to be speaking at that, but that's in May. So go and check it out.
That'd be cool.
Nice. All right, let's wrap it up. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. That was our show.
Yes, go to the forum, go to the Slack channel, join the community, we'll have some fun.